Today, we'll hear from leading climate modeler, Bill Collins, who joined the Earth Sciences Division in April to form a new department called the Department of Climate Science. The department's goal is to create a new kind of climate model that integrates cutting-edge climate science. Bill is also a professor in residence at UC Berkeley's Department of Earth and Planetary Science. He earned his BA in physics from Princeton University and a PhD in astronomy and astrophysics from the University of Chicago in 1988. By then, however, as he says, he was already feeling it again to tackle problems that evolve on a much shorter timescale than that of the cosmos, and which are directly relevant to society. So climate change seemed to fit the bill, which led to postgraduate work at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He arrives at Berkeley Lab from the National Science Foundation's National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, where he led the development of a climate model sponsored by NSF and DOE that ranks among the world's most powerful. This model's ability to simulate atmospheric, oceanic, and terrestrial processes underpinned the February report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, of which Bill was lead author. And this saw a lot of press when it came out in February, if you were following the news. Today, he'll discuss how observations show that the Earth is warming at a rate unprecedented in recent history, and that a human-induced change in atmospheric chemistry is probably the main culprit. Climate models suggest that patterns of global warming will amplify over the 21st century, impacting plants, animals, and society. Improvements in the scientific foundation of climate forecasts will require better observations and understanding of the carbon and hydrological cycles. We'll have time for brief questions after his lecture. Please wait for a microphone, and we'll run it to you because we want to have everybody hear the questions and we are recording it. And again, as people file in, please try to grab a seat, but we have to ask you for fire regulations. We can't have folks standing or sitting in the aisle. So if there isn't enough seats for everyone, this will be videocast and put on the web at a later date. So sorry for that, but please have everyone take a seat. And thanks again for Bill Collins' lecture. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a real honor to be here. And I'm going to talk to you about where we think we are in understanding how climate is changing, both in its past, the present manifestations of climate change, and where we think climate is going to go in the future. And then I'll talk a little bit at the end about our plans here at Lawrence Berkeley to sort of start taking some next steps. What do we do now that we understand that climate is changing? I'm going to be representing the work of quite a few people, the assessment activities that we've just concluded are coming out under an organization called the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. It's a very ugly name for a very talented group of several hundred scientists who spent the last 4 years working very hard to understand how climate is changing, what those changes mean for the impacts on plants, animals, and people, and how we might try to adjust those changes. And so I'll be stepping you through the findings from the report that deals with the science of climate change. And I'll be primarily focusing on how the physical climate has changed, not so much with the impacts on plants, animals, society, because my work is really related primarily to the physical climate. And I'm going to be showing you some figures that are unfortunately fairly technical. This report is designed for a fairly technical audience, and even the figures that were designed for government ministers still are beyond, I'm afraid, some of our current political leadership. And so I will show you those figures and then attempt to give you the take-home message from some of the more technical graphs I'll present. I want to talk about a few key questions. First, how has this physical climate changed in the recent past? And then how does this relate to sort of the energy budget for the planet, the amount of energy that comes into the planet, the amount of energy that leaves, and how are we changing that? Can we figure out whether or not these changes are due to natural causes or whether or not they're induced by people? And I think this is really the $64,000 question that we have to answer. And I'm pleased to say that I think we have an unambiguous answer to this question now. Based on this evidence, then where do we think the climate will go in the future? And then because I'm an optimist, I want to end on some steps that we can take to begin to address these questions. So let me start with the evidence for physical climate change. And this is one of those issues where the evidence is literally all around us. Let me start with Glacier National Park. This is a park I went to as a graduate student when I was earning my degree in astronomy and astrophysics in the 80s. And I just wanted to show you one piece of evidence from this park that things have changed in this century. This is one of the glaciers in the park. Let me switch to laser pointer B. There we go. This is one of the glaciers in the park just before the Second World War. This is that same glacier today, and as you can see, it's more or less collapsed. And there's quite a large lake lying at its base, which wasn't present there only 70 years earlier. So there's lots of evidence run under our noses that climate has changed. Now, the way that climate scientists tend to look at this is from a global perspective. So I'll be showing you a lot of evidence that's been taken from the region, say, of Montana, and then aggregated up into a global score for the climate. And let me start with the most important score, and that's the Earth's temperature. And as I promised you, I'm going to show you a lot of fairly technical graphs, but I'll give you the take-home message. This left-hand graph shows you that the Earth's temperature has increased by about 3/4 of a degree Celsius since the middle of the 19th century, so since the start of industrialization, and it's increased everywhere where we've looked. It's increased on land, on oceans, and it's increasing faster on land than over oceans, although it's hard to tell that from this graph. So we have direct evidence, thanks to the work of Lord Kelvin, and his colleagues since then, who became quite fascinated with measuring temperature, that the Earth's temperature has increased. Now, there have been some scurrilous assertions made by people like Michael Crichton in his book, State of Fear, that this is largely an artifact of the way that we measure temperature, and it's due to the fact that most of the thermometers are concentrated in cities. Well, the one thing, I won't go through this graph in detail, but the fact that this line is horizontal means that there is no trend and our temperature records because those thermometers are located in cities. In other words, Michael Crichton's State of Fear is unfortunately wrong. I should point out that he is the only person who has met with members of this administration on climate science, unfortunately. So his view is prevailing, but he's dead wrong. Now, the temperature is changing not only at the surface, and again, this is one of these complicated graphs, which I won't go through in detail, but it's changing throughout the whole atmosphere. So not only the surface is warming, but the air all the way up to the upper part of the atmosphere that's well mixed, all of it has increased in temperature, while the stratosphere, the part of the atmosphere that holds the ozone layer, which is critical for life on Earth, that has been cooling. This signature of a warming lower atmosphere and a cooling upper atmosphere is completely consistent with our climate models of climate change. This is, in fact, basically a big fingerprint that is consistent with the fact that we are the cause of climate change. And I'll come back to this point a little bit later. At the same time as we've been heating the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere has become moister. This is consistent with the basic laws of thermodynamics. And so the lower atmosphere, the so-called troposphere, is increasing in its temperature by about 1/6 of a degree Kelvin per decade. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the conversion from metric to English units, you just multiply this by about a factor of 2 to get Fahrenheit. So this is about 1/3 of a degree Fahrenheit per decade. And to translate that, what that means is that over a century, we're looking at about 3 degrees Fahrenheit increase in the temperature of the lower Earth's atmosphere. And at the same time, the atmosphere is getting moister. And this is completely consistent with thermodynamic laws. Now, how does this look in the context of history? If we can actually use records to go back and place this recent time period, the last 150 years, in context. And those records, fortunately, go back literally hundreds of thousands of years, thanks to data that we have from ice cores. I won't go into those long records. I'll just show you the last roughly 1,000 years, basically the period of starting with the Middle Ages, William the Conqueror, up to the present day. And you can reconstruct the temperature at the Earth's surface by drilling boreholes into it and by using other lines of evidence that are known as proxies. We obviously don't have temperature records since before the invention of the thermometer, but we can estimate, we can sort of calibrate these proxies using modern day thermometers and then run backwards to see how temperature has changed. And what these proxies indicate is that it's very likely that the last 50 years have been the warmest in the last 500. So basically since the period of King Henry VIII. This is an unusually warm period. And this, you know, same conclusion applies the deeper you go into the past. So the Earth's atmosphere is warming, and this is unusual. Some of the data that we have is a lot more recent. It depends on the use of satellites. Since the invention of satellites, and these really, a lot of these satellites just came online really in the 1980s, we've been able to map the Arctic and the Antarctic in unprecedented detail. And this is a map of the sea ice coverage, shown in this sort of white and purple color, derived from a modern NASA sensor. And so our satellite records, unfortunately, only go back 20 years, but they show a very steady and rapid decrease in the amount of ice covering the Arctic over this 25-year time period. And the rate of this decrease is pretty fast. It's about 7.5% per decade. So again, if you project out a century, and if this trend continues, we're looking at a reduction in sea ice cover by 3/4 by the end of the century. And I'll come back to this point a little bit later in my talk. So this is also quite a fast trend in the climate system. And it's one you would expect. Obviously, ice melts when you heat it up. There are also trends in land glaciers. I started off by talking about the glaciers in Glacier National Park. Obviously, those glaciers are, you know, appreciated for their scenic beauty, but these glaciers are very important for their input into our water supply. Boulder, where I just moved from, gets a third of its water from the Rapo Glacier, which sits in the foothills of the Rockies immediately west of Boulder. And there are billions of people, literally, in India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan who depend on the glaciers nearby for their water supply. So what's been happening to those glaciers? Well, if we start at a baseline of the year 1900, so the beginning of the 20th century, and we sort of adjust all we say, let's start from this, we're going to assume that all the glaciers have 100% of their surface area. How has that surface area decreased? Well, it's decreased by 80% to the present day. In other words, we've gone from 100% of their surface area in 1900 to 20% at the present day. So again, a very rapid decrease. This applies to essentially all the major glaciers on Earth. And this is one example in India where the glaciers are retreating at the rate of a kilometer every couple of decades. So it's really melting pretty quickly. And this is a tongue of ice in a valley in the mountains in northern India. So rapid decrease, and this decrease may account for about 1/4 of the increase in sea level that we're seeing. So let me talk about sea level. Again, we're fortunate that our predecessors took a lot of measurements. Some of these weren't really of laboratory quality, but we can use them to estimate how sea level has risen. And this is, I apologize, this whole report is written in metric. So for those of you who aren't comfortable with metric, I'll have to do, you know, I'll have to translate as we go along. And so now let me just see if I can do the translation in my head. This is about 1/3 of a meter, which is about 1 foot of sea level right here. This vertical axis corresponds to about 1 foot. And what we've seen is a steady increase since, again, the middle of the 19th century up to the present day. We have crude data taken from a variety of shoreline stations and then modern tide gauges. And then now we have very comprehensive satellite altimetry that measures the ocean's surface altitude at all times of day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a year. And this record is all very consistent, and it points to an increase in sea level. Now, this is one of the aspects of climate change that's been in the news quite a bit, because it affects people who live in coastal regions. About half the US population lives within a few miles of shore. And there are other countries that are completely dependent on the fact that the ocean is not changing in altitude. One of these countries where I've been to do an experiment is the Maldives. This is a beautiful coral atoll in the middle of the Indian Ocean, just north of the equator. Has a population of just under 40,000 people and a mean elevation of just under 2 meters, or just under 6 feet. And to give you an idea of what 30 centimeters of rise will do to the Maldives, the Maldives Islands were hit by a 30 centimeter wave during the great tsunami of a few years ago. And that had disastrous impacts on the islands. They are actually considering having to move en masse from the Maldives. In other words, this island, atoll, will be unpopulated by the end of the century if present trends continue. So sea level right now is rising at the rate of about 3 millimeters a year, which is tiny. It's about the stack of three dimes. But again, add that up, that becomes 30 millimeters over a century, which is starts to get appreciable. It's about a foot. So now I need to, I've shown you some evidence for how climate is changing. I need to talk a little bit about why it's changing. And I'll explain this in terms of the energy budget of the Earth. So the energy budget is kind of like an economy. You have the input of sunlight and you have the output of heat. And that's, those inputs and outputs are now quantities we can measure, again, directly from satellite. This is a satellite map of the amount of sunlight incident on the Earth from space, and this is the amount of heat being emitted to space from a modern NASA satellite. And I just wanted to illustrate to you that we now have the capacity to measure this data and monitor it continuously. And we're looking for changes in the energy budget with time. So you can see that there are fluctuations in here. These are associated with clouds. You can clearly see the continents. You can see the oceans, which are a little bit more cloud-free. Some of the other features in here to note are the clouds over the roaring 40s and howling 50s in the storm tracks around Antarctica. You can see the bright deserts of the Sahara, the convection over the Amazon. So a lot of features that you can pick out by eye. And I don't want to go into the details, so I'm not going to go into the details of this graph or anything. But let me just point out that the reason why we have a habitable Earth is because of trace chemicals in the Earth's atmosphere. So the blanket effect of the Earth, which is known as the greenhouse effect, is due to chemical compounds that are literally measured in parts per billion or trillion. So as you may know from high school chemistry, 98% of the Earth's atmosphere is made up of oxygen and nitrogen. That does not cause the greenhouse effect. It's these trace chemicals that are caused by the greenhouse effect. The other key thing to note, to remember about the Earth's energy budget is that the Earth likes to be in balance. And so under normal circumstances, meaning before humans came on the scene, the amount of sunlight coming in and the amount of heat going out on long time scales were roughly in equilibrium or in balance. And we can change that by either putting more particulates into the atmosphere, which reflect sunlight back to space, or by increasing the concentrations of these greenhouse gases. So what's happened to the chemical composition of the Earth's atmosphere? And again, we're lucky that we have these excellent records of the Earth's climate from ice cores. Ice cores, you might ask, well, what's the virtue in having a piece of ice from a glacier? Well, the virtue of that piece of ice is that it has air trapped in it, in bubbles. And you can go in and analyze the amount of greenhouse gases in those bubbles and literally map out for hundreds of thousands of years the chemical composition of the Earth's atmosphere. And in the very near future, we will have a record from Antarctica that goes down to bedrock, which is about it's a time series that's a million years long of the Earth's chemical composition. And I'm just showing you a very short portion of that record, starting from the last glacial maximum. This is when, for example, we think people crossed the Bering Strait into Alaska, into North America. So this is back at the time of the cave paintings in France. Up 10,000 years, this is when we believe that humans first began forming agrarian societies. And of course, biblical times are back sort of starting from 5,000 years on up. So this record goes back well into our own history, well beyond our written history. And what I'm showing you is the amount of the concentration of carbon dioxide, which is the primary greenhouse gas in the Earth's atmosphere, and another important greenhouse gas, methane, as a function of time, going from 20,000 years before present up to present day. I don't want you to worry about the vertical axes. The main thing to notice is that the concentration didn't change very much, and it changed fairly slowly up until the present day. And then it took off very rapidly. The gray bar on these graphs shows you the total variation in this concentration of this greenhouse gas over 650,000 years. So this goes back well into the period before we think that human beings walked off the African continent. And this spike that's occurred in the last 150 years is equal to the magnitude of that variation over 650,000 years. So something is happening fairly, fairly rapidly and fairly dramatically to the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. Now let me, I'm going to translate this into a concept that I deal with, which is the concept of radiative forcing. And I don't want you to really worry about the term radiative, I just want you to worry about the term forcing. The way that climate scientists view people, and I guess this is a reflection of the fact that we're physical scientists, is that people are sort of like we're a disturbance on the natural climate system, and that's what we call this a forcing. We're sort of forcing the climate to do something it wouldn't normally do. And what we're showing you is that, remember I talked to you about the concept of the Earth's energy budget? This is how we're changing the amount of heat being trapped in the Earth's atmosphere since the middle of the 18th century. And the, again, I don't want you to worry about the units. Just to put this in context, one tick mark on this graph is equal to a Christmas tree light bulb per square meter of the Earth's surface, or roughly one Christmas tree light bulb per square yard on the Earth's surface. So it's a tiny, tiny disturbance to the Earth's energy budget. But this is our reconstruction based on that chemical evidence plus some other calculations of how we have increased the amount of energy being trapped with the Earth's atmosphere, the greenhouse effect of the Earth's atmosphere. And we call this a forcing. And this is what, I'll come back to this point in a minute. We now believe we have very good evidence that this is the primary driver for those changes that I showed you at the beginning of the talk, the increases in temperature, the decrease in sea ice, and so forth. So I'm going to do two things in this talk. I've started off by talking about how the climate has been disturbed. I'm now trying to work my way back up to the causes, and we're talking about this concept of radiative forcing, how human beings might be altering the energy budget. And I'm going to come to a minute in who's responsible for this, nature or man? And then when I look forward into the future, I'm going to go the other way. I'm going to start with how we think we might change the composition of the Earth's atmosphere in the future, how that will force the climate, and how the climate will respond. So I'm going to go this way first and then back this direction in the middle of my talk. So again, I'm sorry I'm showing you so many graphs from the IPCC, but the message I want you to take away is that these graphs are the synthesis of the work of hundreds of people, and we think, at least from our perspective, that they form a case beyond a reasonable doubt that humans are the agents for climate change. Let me, before I prejudice the case, though, let me show you the increase in carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. So one of the things we know for an absolute fact is that the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been increasing steadily since we've been able to measure it. And these are measurements made from a station in Mauna Loa. And the black curve is the thing I want you to focus on now. It's the concentrations of carbon dioxide. You can see the seasonal cycle associated with the activity of plants on the land masses in the northern hemisphere, which caused this big cycle. But the main thing to notice is that it's been increasing. And it's now at this, it's gone off graph now. The concentrations are above 380 parts per million in the year 2006, if I remember correctly. So why do we think this is due to people as opposed to some sort of natural increase? Because after all, I've shown you direct evidence that carbon dioxide has changed quite a bit in the past before mankind would have been able to influence it. There are two lines of evidence. One of them is that the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere is decreasing. Now, not to worry, we're not going to, I wouldn't start breathing, don't start breathing heavily now. I mean, this is a very tiny change in the amount of oxygen. But it is consistent with the combustion of fossil fuels. And the other more direct and in my mind, compelling evidence is that there's carbon comes in different flavors, or what are known as different isotopes. And the isotopes that you find that are, this refers to the mass of the nucleus of a carbon atom. And for various reasons, the isotopes that you find that are exchanged among plants and animals in the ocean have a certain flavor of carbon, or a certain isotope characteristic. And the carbon that's stored in fossil fuels, because it's been out of contact with the systems for so long, has a sort of a different mix of these flavors of carbon. And we're seeing a change in that mix of carbon in the atmosphere, which can essentially only be explained by the release of carbon from reservoirs that are comprised of fossil carbon. You really can't explain this signal that we're seeing if it comes from plants and animals, at least not easily. So we think these are two lines of pretty good evidence, the decrease in oxygen and the change in this mix of carbon atoms in the atmosphere, that both point to fossil fuels as being the culprit. I'll skip some other things that we're doing to the atmosphere just to focus on the sun for a second. So I've been sort of hammering on this issue of who's responsible, and there are a couple of other agents which may be playing a role, one of which is the sun. The sun does not put out the same amount of light day to day, year to year, decade to decade, or even century to century. And we know that there was a period in the late 17th century called the Modern Minimum, which is sort of Europe's miniature ice age, and it got very cold. This is the period of Cromwell and the upheaval in England, for example. It got appreciably colder all over Europe, and this is very well recorded. You can even see evidence for it in paintings. So there's sort of a climatic art history, in a way, that's used to look at some of these issues. So the sun can change, and its output has changed over time. We can now reconstruct that using modern satellite records. And the evidence is that it's changed by a bit, but not much, about 0.04% since 1700. So that's a tiny change. But this is the input into the Earth's climate system. So the fact that this is increasing could be an explanation for the heating. Because remember, this is the input. It's the driver for the climate system. This graph is way too technical, but the other thing that's going on is that they're volcanic eruptions. These are episodic. We don't think they have a big impact on the climate system as a whole on the long term. And so this is a graph that I will not go through in detail except to point out that we are, I won't even go through the details of this graph really, except to point out that we're now confident that the energy budget of the planet has been tipped in a way that it is now out of balance, and that there's more energy going into the climate system than going out. And we think this is very likely. It's greater than 90%. We're still not sure about some of the short-lived forcing agents. These are atmospheric aerosols. We still can't really explain those in great detail, but we're quite confident about this finding. And if you put more energy into the system, it should heat. That's but sort of a by analogy with the first law of thermodynamics. So, which of these agents is responsible for the recent climate change? It could be human pollution, it could be solar variability, it could be volcanic eruptions. Well, how do we try to tease this apart? Because after all, we have only one Earth, and we can't really go back and query the Earth's climate system in order to, in essence, tease it apart. So the way that we do this is with climate models. And you can think of using a climate model to try to reproduce the Earth's past, which is normally what we do. But we can also use it to sort of play a game of simulation Earth, where we play what-if games with the climate model. And one of the models that we've used for this is a climate model we developed at NCAR. And I want you to ignore all the details in this, except to point out that this model is in the public domain. You're welcome to everything from it, the source code, the data, all our publications. If you want to try running it on your Mac, you're welcome to. It'll run slowly, but I think it will compile and run. So climate modelers are now trying to move into a mode where we're sharing more and more of our data. And one of the reasons why these assessments are possible, by the way, is that we are now in a modern mode of really making these tools available to anyone who wants to use them. So this is one of the models that we've used to assess what's happened in the past. And so we ran one of these what-if experiments. And what I'm showing you is the result of the experiments for the globe, for the global land, and for the global ocean. And there are three lines on these graphs. One of them is the change in the Earth's temperature from the observations. That's shown in black. And again, this is all in metric. So if you wanted to convert it to Fahrenheit, just again, multiply this by about a factor of 2. Then we ran an experiment with a climate model where we sort of threw in the kitchen sink. We put in all the natural and all the man-made forcings that we know how to reconstruct. And that is the magenta curve. And as you can see, over the globe, over the land, and over the ocean, those model simulations, and there are 23 different models that are represented on these graphs, those agree quite well with the data. So let's take human. Beg pardon?
How far back in time can you go?
We've run these experiments back. It becomes difficult to reconstruct the forcing past about 500 years, but we've run them at least back to the Middle Ages, and the message is quite consistent with this. The other experiment that we've run is when we remove all the man-made forcings and we just allow the sun to change and we include volcanic eruptions, the ones that we know how to reconstruct. And you'll notice that those simulations do reasonably well up until about 1960, 1970. And at that point, their difference relative to the observations becomes very statistically significant. We cannot explain the recent warming if you only include natural causes. And so the conclusion here, based on a large number of models, which have very different assumptions about some of the basic aspects of the climate, so this is in some sense exploring our uncertainty about how to represent the physics of the climate, but regardless of that uncertainty, the models with only natural forcings do not, and as far as we know, cannot reproduce the observations. And it's very likely, again, at greater than 90% confidence level, that people are the cause of recent warming. So I think based on this, you know, the question is, well, what's going to happen in the future? So now I want to talk about probably what you came to hear about, which is what's going to happen in the future. And I want to end on an optimistic note, but I'm afraid this is the part of the talk that's going to be sobering. So, but I want to also emphasize before I show you this that I am an optimist at heart. And so I will just point out that I think, in my opinion, I'm going to give you an editorial message now before I show you this stuff. There are no fundamental physical or chemical laws that stand in our way of addressing this issue. It's only a matter of political and social will. So with that optimistic message in mind, I think it is optimistic. Let me start by showing you just our projections of what might happen to the Arctic, because I showed you some satellite data of the Arctic a little earlier in my talk and pointed out that the sea ice has been declining. So let's ask what happens if we now step forward in time. So we're marching now into the future through a number of presidential elections. And what the model is suggesting, this is actually, it was color-coded. This is the sea ice thickness in meters, and it just cycled back to the beginning. But what it showed you is that the ice basically goes from being a little over a meter thick down to no thickness, in other words, it disappears by the end of the 21st century. And it's interesting, you know, there was just an article this morning in the New York Times that Canada is now starting to really patrol actively parts of the Arctic because they're starting to think about how far their territorial waters extend, because this is going to become a real issue. So there are lots of challenges moving forward. What's going to happen to the globe? And remember, I pointed out that climate scientists tend to like to think global, and then we scope down to the regional. So let me start with the global. And one of the major sources of uncertainty for us, it actually is bigger than the differences among climate models, is what path people will take going into the future. And we really don't know that. So we've constructed a variety of scenarios for what might happen. And those scenarios end up, remember, we treat people as if there's some sort of external disturbance in the climate system. So everything gets translated into the changes in chemical composition of the Earth's atmosphere. So we view people just as a means of changing, when I say we, I mean climate scientists. We view people as just a means of changing the Earth's chemical composition. I know that's weird, but that's what we do. And so what we're showing you is how the chemical composition of the Earth's atmosphere will change because of various choices that human society might make. And those range from sort of a fairly progressive trajectory where human societies unite and begin taking concerted action to reduce emissions. And this one actually has a reduction in emissions by 2040 or so. And then other trajectories that are a little bit more like business as usual, and ones where we pursue a fairly independent and fossil fuel intensive trajectory, much like we're doing now. And so we can't, you know, as climate scientists, we really can't, we're not sociologists, we can't presume to guess which one of these trajectories humankind will follow. So we actually simulate all of them and then present this information to the policymakers and let policymakers try to decide which trajectory they think is best. That's what we've done. And what you find here are the consequences of these choices. So if you were actually able to just freeze the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere to its present concentration, oddly enough, the climate would continue to warm. This is an important thing for people to realize. This is not like air quality, where you know you can have great fluctuations in the amount of ozone or particulate pollution in the atmosphere from one day to the next. Carbon dioxide has a lifetime of about a century in the Earth's atmosphere. Chlorofluorocarbons, which we cleverly introduced, they weren't present in nature before, have lifetimes measured in millennia. And so they're going to be there for a long time, and they will continue to warm the climate for a long time. So even if we stopped changing the composition of the Earth's atmosphere, it'll continue to warm, but fortunately that warming is pretty slow. And again, this is all expressed as a change relative to the year 2000. So this is, 2000 is zero on this graph, and then we go up to about 4 degrees centigrade, which is about 8 degrees Fahrenheit. And then depending on which scenario we choose, we go from about, you know, 1.5 up to about 3 degrees Kelvin or 6 degrees Fahrenheit change in the globe. That gets manifested, if you look region by region, very differently. This is going from the eco-green scenario to the more fossil fuel intensive scenario, top to bottom. The major things to point out about this is that you can see as you go to higher concentrations of carbon dioxide, the planet at the end of the 21st century gets systematically warmer. The Arctic is changed dramatically under all these scenarios. It gets warmer by about 12 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the reason why the ice is going to disappear. Land systematically gets warmer than the oceans because it has a much lower heat capacity. The other thing I want to point out is that I made this point a little bit earlier. About 2/3 of the warming we're going to see, even as far out as 2030, is from historical changes. So it's sort of baked into the climate system. We've already changed the composition, and those changes will continue to roll forward through the next 2 decades. So there's very little difference. This is the quandary, I think, for politicians. And it's sort of the challenge for society as well. Our choices in the immediate future, so if we decided to institute crippling taxes on gasoline, the challenge here is that you won't see any consequences from paying twice as much at the pump over the next 25 years. And so the question is, how long can we sustain our political will to take action? Because you won't see any effect from that in the near future. Pretty much it doesn't matter what you do. It makes a big difference to the children of your grandchildren what you do. So that's the challenge, or one of the challenges. I pointed out that Arctic sea ice will be dramatically affected, and I won't go through the details of this graph. Let's just focus on the pictures. This is the amount of the coverage of sea ice in the summer in the year 2000. This is what happens in the year 2100 under sort of a business as usual scenario. Drastic reductions. I suppose if you're interested in sort of shipping around here, this is good news. But I should point out that those ports are going to be resting on permafrost, which is melted down to quite a considerable depth. So whether or not they're able to build sustainable infrastructure for shipping is another question. This whole area is going to melt. There are 10 million square kilometers that are going to melt under this scenario. Sea level. This is again an issue that's come up quite a bit. Sea level will increase depending on whether you're sort of an ecologically friendly or more fossil fuel intensive scenario, anywhere from about 30 up to over 40 centimeters. I remember 2 feet is about 30 centimeters in this graph. Looking out further, there's some concern that we may put Greenland into a tipping point where out after about a millennium or so, it will more or less melt. Once it does that, it will commit about 7 meters of additional sea level rise. So you'll lose large portions of the eastern seaboard of the United States, for example, under that scenario. Last thing I want to touch on, and then I'm going to just very briefly mention our plans at the end in order to leave time for questions. Climate is going to also get a little bit more extreme. So it's not just a change in sort of the mean. There will also be more extreme events. And the ones that we've looked at have mostly involved temperature and precipitation. So these are three different scenarios, again, going from sort of less fossil fuel intensive to more fossil fuel intensive from the upper left down to the lower left. And there are increases in the number of heat, in the duration of heat waves of up to 2 months, with heat waves over 5 degrees Kelvin warmer than the climatological mean. So we're looking, you know, essentially looking at sort of a permanent, really hot summer under some of these more fossil fuel intensive scenarios. This is also true in Europe. The area around the Mediterranean looks identical to this. It's a heat wave, you know, all summer long. Precipitation gets, when you have strong rainstorms, it gets more intense. There are, in some cases, 10% increase in these very violent rainstorms. But there's also large increases in the periods of basically no rainfall, stretches of up to a week or more, a week and a half, when you'll see almost essentially no rain. So you'll see this sort of change in rainfall patterns where when it rains, it's more intense. When it doesn't rain, that lasts for a longer period of time. So I've now talked about how physical climate will change and sort of implied how it might affect people. I'm showing you this in order to illustrate what might happen to Washington. So this, you think, would help get people's attention. This is what happens if there's a 38-centimeter rise in sea level, plus a Category 2 hurricane. Here's the Washington Monument. And so the basin begins rising. The White House is right here, and the Capitol is off the corner of this graph. I have to tell you, I was hoping that there'd be a more dramatic flooding in this. I have to admit. But the sad thing is that the mall gets hammered, and you can see that areas around, you know, for example, the Smithsonian and the National Gallery and the Air and Space Museum have some issues, but the flooding doesn't extend beyond the basin. And so the White House and the Capitol, which is off this graph, are left high and dry. Well, anyway, I mean, this would have serious consequences for the southern Washington. And so the question then is, in all seriousness, what do we do about this? So my motivation for moving out here was to begin connecting the climate modeling that we've been doing to addressing, sort of moving out of being on the ivory tower and looking at how physical climate will change, to begin worrying about the issue of how do we connect this to action. And I'll skip this in order just to point out that we are in the process of forming a center for integrated Earth system modeling with my colleagues here at Lawrence Berkeley Lab and in conjunction with UC Berkeley and partnering actually with the whole UC system and my colleagues back at the National Science Foundation. And our goal is to continue focusing on climate, but to move consequences, policy, and actions to address this front and center, and also understand really how ecosystems will be affected. We have not really built a system that's been designed so far to connect the kind of science that I've done in the past on physical climate to its impacts and to action. And so we actually are literally, in the IPCC assessment that we just conducted, those three groups never met. And in fact, when we did meet, when we met by ourselves, we typically met 8 time zones away from the other working groups. So we need to begin sitting down together, I think, in my opinion, in order to figure out how to link climate to policy. And in the process, I actually think that will allow us to build even better climate models. And I won't, in the interest of time, go through the some of our plans for that. I'll skip those, come back to them if people are interested. Let me just touch on really the, and I just blew by my questions at the end. I'll try to retrieve, this is a risky thing to do. I'll try to retrieve those. Actually, no, I think I'll just stop and take your questions. I think the challenge for us moving forward is we have really strong evidence that climate has changed. We have very strong evidence that people are the cause of this change and that the consequences for the physical climate in the future are serious. And that the impacts on human beings, plants, and animals are all potentially dramatic, although it won't be the end of life as we know it. And so we can make a choice. And the challenge is, are we ready to make that choice? And what we're planning to do here at this laboratory is connect our research and new energy technology directly with the climate modeling that we're doing in order to be able to address those questions. So with that, I'd like to conclude and take your questions. Thanks very much. Yes.
In the past, we had very great changes in the temperature during the glaciation periods. We also know that the moderate climate has been present only in very narrow bands of
yes.
time.
Mm-hmm.
So now the question is that we may very well be that within 500 or 600 years or even less, we are going to get into another glaciation. So the point, my question is, do we need to worry more intensely about mm-hmm. what happens within the next 200 or 300 years,
mm-hmm.
or what might will for sure happen within, say, 1,000?
Well, I'm going to question you on the time scale, but you're absolutely correct. Newton's laws are pretty ironclad, and what they imply is that the amount of sunlight received by the northern hemisphere changes steadily with time, and there are cycles known as Milankovitch cycles that alter the amount of sunlight that's received by the northern hemisphere, and also how that is phased with regards to the annual cycle. And if you go back and look at the ice core record, you can see the direct impact of those variations in the solar input for the Earth's climate, and that's recorded in the ice core data. Now, fortunately, because we have that excellent record and we have Newton's laws and the solar system is not chaotic on timescales of a million years, we know when the next ice age is going to come. And it's not going. We would not enter another ice age for another 30,000 years. So we're going to be living with the consequences of this for millennia. And the problem is, you know, that as I pointed out, some of the more serious consequences, for example, the melting of Greenland, will occur on the timescale of a millennium. So I don't think orbital dynamics is going to ride to the rescue here, unfortunately.
On the thing with Washington, D.C. and the sea levels,
yeah.
What's the chances of that actually happening, like 38, 70 years sea level rise?
Well, that actually is that is close to the consensus projection for this most recent assessment, and it's fully consistent. I mean, it's dangerous to take present day trends and extrapolate them, but present day trends are consistent with about a 30 centimeter rise in sea level by the end of the century. And I should point out that there's evidence that those trends may have been underestimated. Because we're still grappling with how to understand and model glaciers on land. And there's a very real likelihood that Greenland may be more unstable than we think. Greenland right now is losing somewhere between 100 and 200 cubic kilometers of ice every year, which is, when you think about it, that's a huge volume of ice. And the reason it's doing that, people thought for a while this is just because it's melting. It's just like a big ice cube. Well, no, it turns out that it's flowing out to sea. And there are several, there's one major opening that's allowing the ice to flow out to the western part of the Greenland ice sheet. Unfortunately, there are more channels for the ice to flow out of that are currently blocked. And if those get unblocked, we don't know what's going to happen. So it's possible, you know, that these estimates I'm quoting you may be underestimates. And I think in the interest of being, you know, cautious, we should take these as being consensus estimates, but certainly not at the upper bound of what might happen.
You've seen these talks many times, and one thing that really bothers me mm-hmm. is the particulate effects.
Mm-hmm.
Those effects are really important, and the uncertainties are huge. I mean, I've seen uncertainties like 100% on this.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you tell us that you're 90% certain that the man-made drivers will cause
mm-hmm.
The very specific predictions about, for example, melting of Greenland
mm-hmm.
Seem to be based on very smoothed out global average temperature issues, and they don't include the huge variations that we know will occur.
That what?
The huge variations in climate that we know will occur
mm-hmm.
due to small animal natural size.
Well, I think, I mean, the question about particulates is an excellent one. And, for example, you know, we could get lucky and then see an unusual burst of volcanism this century. And There's also been suggestions that we should cool the Earth's climate by injecting particulates into the Earth's atmosphere. It's so-called geoengineering. So particulates, these aerosol particles, do have a dramatic impact on climate. That statement that I made earlier about being that we think it's very likely that we're heating the Earth's climate, that includes a full treatment of the uncertainty in aerosols, and in fact, a very generous uncertainty bar on that. And that uncertainty has been propagated through the calculation. So we've accounted for that in this statement. That said, this is an area where many of us, including a lot of people at this lab, are working very actively to understand the aerosols. And I think you're right to address it as a major uncertainty. I think we have a number of other lines of evidence that the climate has been warming, the ocean heat content has increased, so it's really hard to explain what's going on if somehow particulates going to, you know, have... It's very hard to reconcile the record unless it's greenhouse gases that are driving it. And the reason is that particulates tend to cool the Earth's climate. What we're seeing is a heating. Everything we're seeing is a heating. And the particulates in the aggregate tend to cool. So there's also a sign issue. You really can't explain the historical record if aerosols are somehow the dominant thing we're doing to the chemical composition of the Earth's atmosphere.
Want to inject particulates to cool things off.
That
obviously produces a different system.
So the speaker is asking about some suggestions that have been raised recently, including by the Nobel laureate Paul Crutzen, who was the one of the three people awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for discovering the chemical mechanism behind the ozone hole. And he's worried that we will not develop the political will in time, and so we need a Band-Aid. And that Band-Aid would take the form of, there have been some interesting suggestions made. One of them is to create an artificial volcano. So we would flood the stratosphere with tiny particles that would reflect sunlight. Now remember, this is we have an energy balance for the Earth, and so we would be lowering the input side of the energy budget. It would just be like turning down the sun a little bit. And there have been, you'd laugh, but there have been suggestions about putting a huge sun shield into something called a Lagrange point, which is a point in the Earth-Moon system where you could stick a mylar shield 1,000 kilometers in diameter and literally block the sun's rays from hitting the Earth. My reaction to the particulate idea is I think it's deeply irrational. I think it's the kindest thing I can say about it. The reason I say that is that we know from looking at the way that the cirrus formed by airplanes affect the stratosphere and the way that polar stratospheric clouds cause the ozone hole, that if you stick particles into the upper atmosphere, chemical reactions will occur on the surface of those particles. And those chemical reactions may not be beneficial for the stability of the stratosphere. And the ozone hole is a perfect example. The ozone hole, part of the dynamics behind that is the chemistry that occurs on these tiny, on these fairly wispy clouds called polar stratospheric clouds. And what we're talking about with geoengineering is increasing the amount of reactive surface area where chemical reactions could occur by orders of magnitude and sustaining that for decades, if not centuries. The consequences of that for the stratospheric chemistry are, at this point, unknown. And so that's one of the reasons why I really think it would just be better for us to do the simple thing, which is stop emitting greenhouse gases.
Okay, so we have two questions. Firstly, have you observed in either the data or simulations the effect of the most recent attempts to reduce greenhouse emissions? Mm-hmm. How that could be affected if you did a model by the major polluters?
We can see direct. We know that the emissions of some of the chlorofluorocarbons have rolled off. This is because of the Montreal protocols. So we have direct evidence that some of those species are beginning, that those emissions are declining. I should point out that the scenarios that we ran to look at different pathways for the future, are still broadly consistent with what's happening. There have been some strange things that have happened recently, but the scenarios are still broadly consistent with the current trends. China is on its, you know, China is on a pathway to, in fact, I believe may have already exceeded the United States as an emitter of carbon dioxide, and by the year 2020 will dominate the world's emissions of sulfate particulates. Those effects are included in the scenarios that we use. So we have accounted for some of these recent shifts in socioeconomic activity. I'm not sure if that answers your question, though.
Okay, the second thing is, assuming the most pessimistic scenario, have you ever considered how much time maybe it would have got until...
How much what?
How much time would have got the life circumstantially got until it becomes simply too hot for humans to live.
Repeat the question one more time. I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
If it keeps growing warmer and warmer, mm-hmm. at what point will the human population start dying out?
Okay. Well, I know people in Berkeley have a pretty narrow temperature comfort range. I know you probably think that life as we know it will end once it gets warmer than 85 degrees Fahrenheit. but I can assure you that it won't. I mean, there was just a story on NPR recently about Phoenix, where they're surviving temperature, days where it gets up to 115 degrees Fahrenheit. It can certainly get a lot warmer. My concern here is really not, I think people will land on their feet. What I'm very concerned about is the effect on plants and animals, don't understand what's going on, and their whole ecosystems that are being, I think, decimated is a fair word, because they can't move fast enough to get out of the way of the warming. This century, if you come back and look at it, if there are people around 100,000 years from now, and they come back and look at this century and the fossil record, this century will look exactly like the impact of a major meteor in terms of the impact, in terms of the mass extinction of the web of life. And that, I think, is what concerns me more than anything else about this. It's not people. It's what we're doing at the ecosystem. And we don't really understand how far we can stress that ecosystem before we begin to break critical links in it. I think that's another key question for us.
No.
Let me take this question, then I need to move over to the other side. We do have, there is evidence now that because the ocean is becoming more acidic in response to the increased carbon dioxide, that we're beginning to threaten the ability of single-celled organisms that use calcium compounds as to form exoskeletons, for those microorganisms to survive, because calcium carbonate likes to dissolve and will dissolve as you make the ocean more acidic. Well, that's the base of the ocean food chain. So I'll just leave you with that thought. That's an issue that scientists are beginning to look at very actively. There's a question over here, I believe.
Just real quick, I saw two more hands up over there, so okay. We have time for two more quick questions. Mm-hmm.
Actually, going back to the ocean, I've heard ideas concerning kind of like seeding the ocean to increase the amount of algae, mm-hmm. I guess, like coming off the shipping boats. I don't know if you have any comments about that sort of idea for decreasing CO2 levels.
I'm looking forward. Jim, I should bounce this question to a colleague of mine, but again, I think, who's an expert on ocean biogeochemistry. Jim, let me just give the sort of the Reader's Digest version of your answer. again, we think that is a that idea won't work, and it is extremely ill-advised. However, it is unfortunately becoming very popular. I think we will, we're gonna see, I think, a vast array of snake oil that's being sold as carbon credits. And so you're gonna see a land rush that looks a lot like snake oil at the end of the 19th century. You'll be able to buy carbon credits, when you go into Walmart for your plastic toy made in China. And I think we have to view those mechanisms with a great deal of skepticism. This is something where essentially the consumers need to educate themselves, because you know what a great way to make a profit. You know, here, click here. You know, I don't have to feel guilty about flying on an airplane. I mean, that's something where the buyer needs to be beware.
You said you were optimistic, but I don't hear any.
Fair enough. Why am I optimistic? Because, look, if we were looking at something where a basic law of physics or chemistry said that we cannot reduce emissions, then I would agree that we're in deep trouble. But we have the technology in hand to make dramatic reductions in emissions and make them, you know, pretty much immediately. California started taking action on those, you know, along those lines. Conservation is an easy, well, it's not easy, but it is a way to very quickly begin to reduce emissions, and the potential there is enormous. But California, fortunately, is going to pretty much make incandescent light bulbs a thing of the past by the end of this decade. That's a huge savings. So I know it's naive to think that human nature can change overnight, but there are excellent precedents, recent historical precedents, that when humanity is challenged in this way, that we can take action quickly. Look at what happened with acid rain. That problem was addressed very quickly and very aggressively. We'll look at what happened with the ozone hole. Again, nations realized that this was a critical problem. It was a life-threatening problem, and they took action. Now, I mean, there was some knock-on effects. They substituted one greenhouse gas for another, but at least we're no longer depleting the ozone. And well, the ozone hole will recover by around 2065. So there are some really good recent examples where humanity collectively decided to take action. And that's the reason why I'm optimistic.
And that's a great point, Dan. Thanks again to Bill Paul for that.